Hello and welcome to Manx Radio's newscast. This is where you hear the full interviews of news items that you might have heard on air. This one is from Siobhan Fletcher and it's all about the Isle of Man Airport.
Earlier this month, a number of issues arose at the Isle of Man Airport. Drones were spotted over the sea nearby and flight cancellations affected hundreds of travellers. In order to find out why these incidents happened, Manx Radio was granted exclusive access to the air traffic control tower at Ronald's Way. We went down to find out how everything works and why the airport may not always be to blame. Leading the tour was Jeff Pugh, head of air traffic services.
So what you see in front of you is what we generically describe as the tower, but it contains everything to do with air traffic services. So right at the very top, we've got the visual control room. That's where the aerodrome controller and the air traffic services assistant will sit. The actual main offices and the radar approach room are in this lower part of the building. We've also got all the plant rooms and also air traffic engineering, which is where all of the feeds from the radar, the communications, all feed in to enable us to have the picture to be able to control all the aircraft. This is the approach radar room, currently providing radar services. So we've got an air traffic controller who's providing that, and an air traffic services assistant who is assisting her. And we're mainly concerned in here with getting aircraft away from the island and also bringing them in. So when you're looking at the screen, complicated array of lines and structures which represent the air structures, the airway structures, danger areas. There's obviously the representation of the island at the top of the screen with various overlays on top of that to assist the air traffic controller make the various decisions that they need to make. So most of our traffic, obviously coming from England, will come up the airway from the southeast, and then the big block around the island that you can see around the southern half of the island is our controlled airspace. So anything that moves inside there has to be talking to us and has to have a permission.
Obviously we've had recently where drones have been an issue.
Yeah.
Do they come up on that radar and then obviously you're not aware of what it is, or is it just people sight them and then fly them to you?
At the moment we rely on members of the public or pilots more particularly, or us ourselves in the tower spotting drones. The issue at the weekend you referred to, that was a report from a light aircraft pilot who reported that he'd seen two drones pass beneath him. That's obviously passed to us, and then our responsibility is to make sure that other aircraft are warned about that, or if we think it's a real safety issue, we will stop all arrivals and departures to make sure that we can find out who it is, make sure it's safe before we carry on, which is what we did. Looking for those issues is actually a police matter, so we were liaising with the police over that. Some drones, more modern drones, are starting towards having what's called electronic conspicuity, which means they carry electronics on them that will send us information on the screen, but we don't see much of that over here. In fact, we don't see any of it over here. And that's, you're talking high-end drones for that, but most of the time, no.
Well, can you just talk me through where we are with, the, like you say, the best view on the island?
Well, certainly one of the best views on the island. Yeah, this is the visual control room. As you can see the entire airfield. Again, we've got an air traffic controller and we've got an air traffic services assistant. The controller is responsible for everything that moves out on the aerodrome. That includes vehicles, aircraft. All of your aircraft landing and departing are under the control of the controller here. Most of the time, it depends what's going on in the airspace, but a lot of the time the aircraft will depart and then the controller here will do a couple of checks and we'll send the aircraft straight to the next agency. If there's traffic inbound or it's busy, they'll obviously send it to the controller downstairs, who can then coordinate that traffic before sending it on to wherever it needs to go.
Could you tell me a little bit about how long it goes into training to be an air traffic controller?
So training for air traffic controllers takes a long time. There are two routes in, really. One is for experienced controllers who've already worked at other airports and are coming to us. And the other route is what we call ab initio, which is just Latin for from the beginning. So ab initio controllers, student air traffic controllers who are right at the start of the career. They've not worked anywhere before and they come in. They obviously need to go and do professional courses. There's only two providers of training in the UK. We send ours to Gloucester, and if you're an ab initio student, in total you'll need to do 4 courses, and they reach about 9 or 10 weeks long. And each time you finish one of those, you have to come back, train locally, and then you get your first endorsement, and then you go back to the college, do another course, come back and consolidate that as well. Over a period of about 3 to 4 years, that would probably take for an ab initio controller. For an experienced controller who's worked at another airport and is coming here to us, really that should take between 6 and 12 months. The problem that we've had is over the last 2 or 3 years, of course, with the pandemic, the huge reduction in aircraft movements, which has affected us, not just us, but globally. It's taken a long time to train our controllers. We've still got controllers here who've come as experienced controllers from other airports that we'd expect, 6 to 18 months to validate. They've been here for, in some cases, over 3 years, and they've still not fully qualified. So it does take a long time. And unfortunately, unlike some other areas, for example, medicine and teaching, where you can draft in supply teachers to help out, we can't do that in air traffic control. You can't just find an air traffic controller from another area, bring them in, and they can instantly do the job. It's a minimum, as I say, of 6 to 18 months to get them up and running.
In a particular tower and with the experience of that particular place?
Yeah, as I say, experienced controllers are familiar with the rules, the general rules of air traffic, but every airport's different. So a controller coming in has to learn all of the local procedures, all of the traffic that we generally deal with, the uniqueness of the area here in the island, and it would be the same if they went to any other airport. We're no different. It's just, at the moment, it's taking quite a long time to get through that training.
And also, I know that you're bound to a very specific set of rules in terms of how long you can be up here, how long you can be working. So obviously, to the public, they might just be like, oh, stay an extra 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Why can't you do that? What's the rules around it?
Yeah, it's a fairly extensive and crippling set of regulations that we have to abide by. And there's good reason for those regulations. You don't want to get onto an aircraft with a tired pilot, and you don't want to have your aircraft controlled by a controller who's tired. So those regulations are designed specifically to limit the effects of fatigue on controllers. So as you said, there are limits to the number of duties that they can perform. There's a limit to the number of morning duties in a row that they can do. There's minimum breaks specified on the day, so they can do a maximum of 2 hours in the seat without needing a 30-minute break. They have to have so many rest days in a month, and it goes on and on. So when we fall short, as any workplace would, with sickness, domestic issues, all sorts of things that every workplace would have to deal with, we can't just say, oh, we'll just ask X to stay an hour longer or call someone in, without thinking first about, can we do that within the regulations? Because the staff here understand the important role that they play. We want to facilitate passengers moving out of the airport. Our controllers and our staff are passengers who travel in and out of the airport, so they understand that, and they are all keen to ensure that we are facilitating that. But sometimes all of that goodwill runs up against, we can't allow you to do that because we're asking you to do too much. And I get that that often is not appreciated by the public, because they may think, well, surely just an extra 10 minutes or an extra hour isn't going to make a huge difference. But we work in a very strict regulated industry, and it's all about safety.
So it's not just aircraft that are controlling up here. Can you tell me a little bit about what else is going on?
Yeah, so the operation of an airport requires the cooperation of a number of different sections around the airport. Some of those are related to the upkeep and maintenance of the airfield. If you ever get an opportunity to go out on the airfield, I think people would be surprised actually how big it is. I think there may be a perception that it's just little old Ronald's Way Airport on the Isle of Man, but actually it's a large area out there. There's a lot of infrastructure, there's a lot of technology, and there's a lot of maintenance required. So there's whole teams of people who are responsible for the upkeep and maintenance, but as well as the safety. And of course we've got the airport fire service and all of their vehicles. And an air traffic controller's job is not just to prevent collisions of aircraft in the air and on the ground, but also between those aircraft and the vehicles. So at any one time, we could have 3 or 4 vehicles routinely out on the aerodrome doing that work, and all of that has to be controlled and coordinated by the aerodrome controller here. So even if we've got no aircraft movements and people might see, oh, there's not many flights today, or not much going on, but there's always activity on the aerodrome, and it's the aerodrome controller's responsibility to safely manage that, because particularly at night, if you were to come up here at night or go out onto the airfield at night, it is a big black hole, and driving around in those conditions can be quite disorientating, which is why the requirements and the qualifications required for airside driving at an airport are so restrictive, and that's to keep everyone safe, and ultimately all of that's under the control of the aerodrome controller as well.
You mentioned nighttime flights here. Also, I mean, on this island, it's a bit of an understatement to say that the weather's a bit changeable. We are subject to a lot of fog, a lot of rain. How do you go about communicating with aircraft trying to land in those conditions, and what sort of issues does that throw up as well?
Yeah, so every airport has to deal with poor weather. We have a suite of electronic aids, and aircraft themselves are fitted with electronic aids to help them navigate in poor weather and to land and depart in poor weather. We're a coastal location. You know, the airport's been here for a long time, and you can't override Mother Nature. So we do suffer from poor visibility and poor weather. And a lot of the time, it's not just, obviously there's been a lot of focus on visibility and fog, but it's not just that. You know, we can have visibility reduced by squalls, heavy rain. You get to see a huge variety of weather if you spend some time up in the VCR here. So we take that very seriously, and we have to make sure that the aerodrome is in a safe condition for aircraft to land. When, as you can imagine, if you're sitting here as the aerodrome controller and you can't see the runway, how do you make sure that the aircraft can land safely? But when you talk specifically about visibility, we have, like many other airports, a system called an instrument landing system, ILS, and there are different categories of instrument landing systems. And we have a Cat 1 system, which is very similar to lots of other regional airports of our size, and that's designed to help aircraft get down in pretty poor weather. If you saw the Cat 1 minima, that's a pretty poor weather day. Bigger airports like Heathrow and Gatwick, who have a real, you know, much more traffic, the impact of an aircraft not being able to get in there, if you multiply that out about the number of flights that they get, that's why they invest in much more sophisticated and expensive bits of kit to enable aircraft to pretty much land in zero visibility, auto land. The requirements of infrastructure, geography, and technology that are required to enable that is significant. And in some areas of this airfield, on one end, it's just not possible because of geography. So we've got a big hill in the way over there. So there are limitations. And in the other direction, we've got the sea. The kit that we've got is very good. It will get you in most weather conditions, but it's not the same system as Heathrow, and we're not Heathrow.
We touched very briefly on how long the training period is to be an air traffic controller. Mm. We've also seen recruitment issues across, not just up here in the shops in the airport, also across the Isle of Man in general. We're having a bit of a recruitment crisis, you could say. What are the issues that go into recruiting air traffic controllers then?
Well, a lot of them are the same issues. You know, making a decision on where you want to work is it's a family decision, it's a monetary decision, it's all the usual decisions that someone has to make to go and work somewhere. But on top of that, air traffic controllers worldwide is a highly specialised job, and the training takes a long time. The training is quite expensive, and it's a well-paid job. So the competition for jobs, when they do come up, is significant, and we have to compete amongst all of the other airports that are trying to recruit. Obviously, we've seen during the pandemic, there wasn't much recruitment of air traffic controllers going on because airports saw a huge loss in traffic. In the recovery since then, there has been lots of recruitment. We haven't been in a position to recruit during the pandemic. We already had a significant number of trainees at the start, and therefore, if we were to take on any extra at that time, then the backlog in training when they got to the unit would have been unsupportable. But now, as we look forward, we have to compete with other airports, and the reasons to come to a beautiful island, small island, might seem obvious in some sectors, but we have to compete with other airports for the talent in air traffic control, so it's a real challenge.
After our tour of the air traffic control tower, I then sat down with Jeff and airport director Gary Cobb.
What do we have to get to a point where you have to make an announcement where we're short of air traffic controllers? Do you often have incidences that we wouldn't even know about?
Absolutely. It's never a binary decision. The amount of work that goes into preventing issues from even coming to the attention of the travelling public is significant. We have the ability to run all of our services just with one person, one controller, plus an assistant in the top of the tower where you've just been in the visual control room, because we haven't got a controller who can be in radar. That actually requires an additional rating. So we talked about the qualifications required to be an air traffic controller here. We're not unique, but it's not that common for airports in the UK to require what's called an APP rating. So you're an air traffic controller, it's going to be lots of acronyms, I'm afraid. So I'll try and make it easier. But when we talk to the aircraft that are departing and arriving in the island, we can do that. Obviously, our preferred way is to use surveillance, to use radar. But when we are short of staff, we can do it without radar. And that requires the controller to have an additional rating. It's an additional course that they have to go on, an additional training that they do. We do that as standard. So if an air traffic controller arrives here without that rating, which is quite common, we will send them on the course to be able to do that. That really enables us to operate the airport from an air traffic control perspective with one person plus an assistant. And I don't know whether that might be a surprise to people that it's just one person. So yes, we have a whole range of things that we can do to try and stop issues stopping us providing a service, to stay open, to keep providing that service. So when we get to situations like we did on Sunday where we thought we were going to have a problem, we were right at the end of all of those options. You know, we'd exhausted all of the other options, or we thought we had, and that's why we gave an early heads up to the airlines to say, look, we may have a problem tomorrow, we want you to know about it. But as it turned out, we did manage to fix it, we did find cover, and we opened as normal. So yeah, there's a huge range of things that we try to do before we get to that decision where we have to say we've ran out of options.
And Gary, just to throw it over to you, while we're on the topic of Sunday then, obviously that warning went to the airlines, then EasyJet particularly made the decision to cancel. Is there no control then or warning to say, I assume you told them we're trying to solve this issue, they've made that decision to go ahead and cancel it. What's the airport's response then to that? Because obviously the airport then gets a lot of criticism of a decision presumably made by EasyJet.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So if you look at the time on Sunday, so we had tried to source cover internally. We then were starting to exhaust our options. We still had some, but we were waiting back. So we thought, let the airlines know as possible, because if they did need to cancel, that can take time. And what we didn't want to do is passengers to go to bed and then have to wake up in the morning and then realise that their flight's cancelled. They've got no other ways of either communicating, working what they're doing, or sourcing alternative means of leaving the island. We were lucky, we managed to source it and get back in contact with the airlines pretty quickly. Fortunately, Loganair then reinstated their flight and flew out. As Jeff said, we were open in the morning and they flew out as per normal. EasyJet cancelled. Airlines cancel flights for a multitude of different reasons. Some linked to the airport that they're flying from, some linked to the airport that they're flying to. Can be down to crew, can be down to lots of other operational reasons that we have no sight of. So in terms of an airline cancelling, we have very little impact on that. We can have conversations with them, but ultimately the choice for them to fly is for them themselves. And that's an example of almost with the Gatwick flight in the evening, where they choose to fly it once it's getting to the point where we'll need an extension to stay open. So they will then choose to either try and chance it and then do it, or they'll cancel. But they know our closing times, they know the capabilities that we can go out, and we give them weekly updates in terms of when we can stay open. So they've got this is an information that we give them on the day. We'll tell them weeks in advance of, actually, we're going to struggle to source cover tonight to be able to offer a staying open and extension. But again, their decision on the day is entirely up to them and will be based upon what their flying of that aircraft has gone for the multiple sectors, what the crew's doing, what other issues have got across the network, and do they want to protect a different flight compared to ours, or do they just want to chance it and see if they'll get in before it closes. So again, it's up to the airlines themselves.
Ultimately, a lot of the time, they do take that chance to come, and then, like we said upstairs, a traffic control, that's very strict rules. So what would your message sort of be to the public in those times when it seems like the issue's on the airport end? Do you want to clarify anything to do with that?
Yeah, if you have a look at our cancellation rates, we're pretty standard across industry. I think we've had about 3% of our flights cancelled this year. However, the big proportion of that was cancellations that happened, I think it was in May, June, July, which is when the rest of the UK aviation network had their difficulties, where you saw mountains and warehouses of bags that we didn't have, where you saw queues greater than 60 minutes, which we didn't have. We were quite lucky. So we saw cancellations there. The majority of those cancellations were linked to other airports where they couldn't get in, or delays that they were seeing with air traffic control across Europe or in some of those destination airports. If you were to count on your hand the number of actual closures or cancellations caused by the airport itself, you could probably do it on one, maybe into two, across the whole of 2022. There is very little previous to me coming in or whilst I've been here of a closure that's been caused by us. Another example is where we've had quite a lot of complaints with the shear pin shearing on the stand. Again, we saw that it was on the runway, and there was an announcement by an EasyJet pilot that that had never happened before. I used to work at Gatwick. As you would expect, shear pins shear on a relatively frequent basis. It was a case of sourcing more equipment. That was on the stand, it was nowhere near the runway, it was nowhere near the taxiway, and the pilot is probably just saying what's easiest to keep 155 passengers in a metal container with himself, nice and calm and collected. And unfortunately, we are a very easy target for people to blame. So typically airports contribute to a very, very small number of cancellations across the network, and ultimately it is down to that airline to cancel.
Do you think then that ultimately it's a public misconception then, maybe brought on by the fact that we're such a small island and it's such a small airport and there's not that many flights, that actually it looks like, oh, there's all these cancellations, but actually relative to any other airport, like you say, there aren't that many?
Yeah, so probably my previous job was Chief Operating Officer for Highlands and Islands Airports Limited. So Inverness was a pretty similar size to what we've got here at the Isle of Man. The level of cancellations that we're seeing is pretty standard. They had Loganair and EasyJet as their two main carriers, so exactly the same as us, had exactly the same sources of cancellations, typically on the Gatwick. So again, Inverness had a restriction on the extensions that their ATCOs could go to, typically 11 o'clock. I used to fly quite extensively there. I regularly got stuck and couldn't fly in because they picked up too many delays in the day, and then they had to cancel in Inverness. It's far easier when you're on the mainland to be able to find source alternative routes, whereas for us as an island, it's much more complicated and have a much greater impact. But in terms of what I see an airport that has very similar issues to all the other airports, probably less to some extent, in terms of the actual cancellations and also some of the delays. So we don't see the issues in security, we don't see the issues with luggage that are in the UK airports at the moment. So yeah, it can get a little bit frustrating when it gets quite sensational that shambles is a word that was used, when in actual fact it was an airline chose to cancel that flight. And I can understand it's one in the previously with different airlines, they've not necessarily understood the difference between an airport and an airline. If you to have a look at an airport, the easiest example of using for an airport is a landlord. So we make sure that the aircraft can get into our airspace and get out of our airspace with our air traffic control. We have our fire service on hand to be able to deal with any emergency that should happen whilst that aircraft is here. We have an airfield ops team that look after the maintenance of the ground, the equipment, and to keep us safe from wildlife. Security teams that make sure people get through very, very quickly, and then works in terms of the terminals and some of the periphery third parties that help us do what we do. Our job is to do that. In terms of the airlines coming in and airlines coming out, that is entirely up to the airlines. And you'll see some debates over open skies or closed skies in terms of control. There's no way that you can control an airline. They will do what they want to, and they will go where it is more commercially viable for them. But we can work with our airlines to try and explain the frustrations of the population of Isle of Man and some of the issues that that's causing, and try and help them improve some of their performance. But again, normally out of our hands.
And now we touched upstairs on the radar system and how people always say we need a new radar, but actually you're saying the one we've got works fine for where we are. Another thing that people always throw out is that the runway is too short. Can you explain to people why it's not really feasible to extend that runway?
Yeah, so in terms of the runway distance, a runway has a lot of components. You've got the physical actual runway. We have to protect that runway with a load of invisible surfaces. And that's predominantly designed around an aircraft losing an engine. So if an aircraft was to lose an engine whilst taking off, it's not going to climb as high. It's going to go quite a lot further. We have to plan for that and make the whole area safe. If you have a look at the geography of where we are, we're bound by, is it the A5, and we're bound by the sea. So in terms of distances that we can go, we are kind of stymied. If you were to have a look at, and then you go into the ILSs, which has been spoken about before, of how you can bring aircraft in. If you have a look at Jersey, you have a look at Sunbury and Shetland. Both islands, both have exactly the same geographical limitations as we do. Both have Cat 1. Cat 1 will get you in the majority of the time in low visibility. That doesn't necessarily need to be fog. It can be rain squalls. It can be just cloud base coming down. You've seen how high the tower is and people looking in. In terms of extending that ILS, yes, you can do some things with lighting, but again, you're going into the sea. You're talking tens of millions of pounds to put those lights into the sea. You'll have to do a whole host of other things in order to protect the surfaces to be able to allow an aircraft to go off, and that is in one direction only. If an aircraft was to come in from the other direction, the geography of the hills and the mountains will prevent us having a glide slope that they could go, which would have an ILS greater than Cat 1. So even if we were to do one end, we'd never be able to put a greater than a Cat 1 ILS on the other end. And what you have there is probably the worst situation of a runway that has different minima. So should that Gatwick take off in foggy conditions here, and the wind's favouring it coming in because we've done spent the tens of millions, we've put the lights in, we've done all the other bits, and then the wind changes, it's going to have to turn around because the other way it'll never get it. So how we do work in doing the minima, it's one where the cost almost prohibits the amount of disruption that it will cause. But again, as technology moves on, as we look at what we're doing, we'll continue to have a look at what we can do to reduce that minima so that more and more flights go off. But in the grand scheme of the number of days lost compared to the cost, if I was to be given the tens of millions of pounds to fix the ILS, I'm pretty sure the Isle of Man public would prefer me to spend that in lots of other areas to improve customer experience and other things that go on at the airport, rather than the 1 or 2 days that would probably still be too foggy for even a Cat 2 ILS to be able to cope with.
Minister Chris Thomas talked this week about this master plan that's being worked on for the airport. Some money obviously is going to be needed from Treasury for that. Does the airport actually need more money, or is it bad management? And when you get that money, where in particular would we actually see that go?
The typical purchases of airports are private equity, and the reason for that is it's a steady amount of capital that they spend versus the income that they generate. Airports always need maintenance, they always need their kit upgrading. If you have a look at our radar, one of the things that I find quite amusing here coming onto the island is I hear about the new control tower that we're currently in. I think that was done in 2000, so it's what, 30 years old, is it?
I think it started in 2008. 2011, I think.
So 20 years old. So new control tower, 20 years old. Lifespans of towers, typically somewhere between 30 and 40, so mid-life, and will need some work going on in the future. Runways typically need resurfacing 7 to 8 years. The fire station down at the south of the airfield has been there for a long, long time and needs modernising. You have a look at the terminal and everyone has their views on terms of how we modernise and update it. So in terms of has the money been spent badly, I don't think that's the case. I've only been here for 8 weeks, so I can have a look back and I don't see stuff that was done that you think, oh, well, that was a vanity project or that was silly. Extending the runway is useful, you get longer aircraft. At some point, we may have it where we want to fly to longer destinations and have 737s land. They wouldn't have been able to land previously, probably, now that they can. So in terms of looking at the money being spent, that's quite good. If I was to have a look at where we want to spend the money in terms of the master plan going forward, I think there's a lot that we can do with terminal redevelopment, so to make it so that that passenger journey is much better. I see at times when I'm out there meeting passengers, if you have 2 or 3 EasyJets in, it gets very, very cramped very, very quickly. So how can we increase the space airside for passengers with multiple aircraft, because we want to grow? And then also having a look at where food and beverage is sold. So at the moment, Costa, I know that lots of people have issues queuing for the Costa because there's only one till. So what can we do to make it so that it's a much better experience for passengers? Part of the master plan, we'll be having a look at that. The other part of the master plan will be a little bit further off. We know at some point we're going to need new radar. We know that we're going to need hangar bridge and other bits. So how do we spread that cost to make it so that the airport can reduce its burden on the taxpayer by generating more income? So again, but a master plan is not a short thing to do. This will take us, to do it properly, will take us a couple of months to be able to do. And once we're at the point where we can do it, again, we'll probably invite you in or share it with the public of some of our ideas.
Are there any other public misconceptions you would challenge then?
So one, sometimes it's quite interesting to hear what's said. Our teams aren't immune to what goes on social media and some of probably the unfair comments that come on. And you see some of the myths that are raised, which can be quite frustrating. I typically see that we only have 6 air traffic controllers, which again, I think today you've seen 3 of them, which if that was the case is half the team. I'd see us struggling to open for longer than that. In terms of our actual numbers, we have 14, 4 of which are trainees, who 2 part validated, 2 going through it, and then 10 that are fully validated. But again, they'll be doing the both positions, they'll be on leave, and then you have sickness on top of it. In terms of, a lot of people talk about recruitment of air traffic controllers, and I know that Jeff spoke earlier about ab initios and experienced. I know in the past people have mentioned that they want to see more recruitment of people local to the island. In the last 3 years, 72% of our ATCO recruitment has come on island in the ab initio camp. Ab initios are great because they're local, they tend to stick. Unfortunately with ab initios is they're learning a brand new skill, and unfortunately of the 5 ab initios that we've seen locally, 4 haven't unfortunately made it to ATCO, whilst 1 is still in college training. So it's a riskier, longer way of getting ATCOs than going externally. However, the risk with external ATCOs is, although they've got the skills, sometimes they may still not validate, but they may also not stop because this is just one path of their career. So it's not an easy fix when people sit there and say recruit locally, because that is a much longer issue, especially when you have a short-term problem. And it's not a guaranteed solution because the failure rates are much higher in an ab initio than they are in an experienced ATCO that you recruit off island.
What does it take then to be an air traffic controller just on the day-to-day?
Once you've become qualified as an air traffic controller, the challenges don't really stop there. Obviously, you have to maintain your ongoing competence, but as with pilots, air traffic controllers are required to achieve very strict medical standards, and those medical standards are very similar to pilots. So once you become an air traffic controller, age obviously brings with it lots of medical issues that air traffic controllers have to keep on top of. You know, there are very strict requirements for things like blood pressure and all the usual things that can afflict us as we get older. And then if people do manage to stay on the right side of keeping their medical, you know, something that might not affect another employee who works in an office, you know, they get a bad cold or a headache. Air traffic controllers are legally not required to control if they are not feeling fit to control. And so the margins at each end to keep people competent to do the job, or selected first, then trained, remain competent, remain fit, and, you know, don't get a cough or a cold or a headache too often, because all of those things can contribute to people not being able to be fit to control. So it's multidimensional chess every day, trying to keep the roster going.
If someone was considering a career as an air traffic controller, is there a particular quality they should have about them, or how would they go into it?
Well, a good thing about becoming an air traffic controller is it doesn't actually require any formal qualifications, educational background or educational achievement. Actually, the only qualification requirement is a language proficiency requirement, and that's in English, obviously. So apart from that, it's a really good opportunity for people who don't want to go down a formal educational background, whether that's at school or university. But being an air traffic controller does require your brain to be wired in a particular way, and we have banks of tests that help us identify those people to give them the best opportunity throughout the rest of their training. So it is a great opportunity to get into a highly rewarding career that is paid well, it is highly specialised, and you get to do a huge range of activities, whether you stay at the airport where you started or whether you go on to bigger and greater things. It's a really exciting opportunity, and we do recruit locally. As Gary said before, we've recruited 5 student ab initio air traffic controllers in the last 3 or 4 years, and we will continue to do so. It is a great source of talent, particularly here on the island.
and you are paid whilst training as well, which isn't necessarily the case in, you know, a lot of different trades.
Yes, so as would be the case in lots of other, there's a sliding scale of salary, and when you come in as a trainee, you're at the bottom end of that scale, but it's a scale, and it's a good starting salary. You're paid to go on those training courses. Those training courses are very expensive. Specialist training, they take place in the UK, so we send people off the island. We support them through that training. We pay them in the role when they're doing it. We pay the course fees, and when they come back and successfully validate, they then start to move up the pay scales as they gain those qualifications.
And yourself, are you from the island? Did you train here? Did you train somewhere else? What's your sort of career trajectory look like?
Yep, I'm a Manxie. I might not sound like it, but I was born and raised here. I went to school locally, left at 18 to go to university. I did an engineering degree and then stayed in Manchester. I went to university for a few years, and then I took the military path. So I joined the Navy in 2001, initially as air crew, and then I transferred to air traffic control, and then spent 17 years as a controller and other types of air traffic control related jobs in the Navy before my sisters every now and again would send me job adverts looking for opportunities for me to return home to the island, and I did so at the back end of 2019, just before the pandemic.
And that concludes our tour of the air traffic control tower at Ronald's Way. I'm Siobhan Fletcher, and you're listening to Manx Radio.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Little Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.